Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show for November 7th, 2009. This is Michelle Steinberg of EIR's Counterintelligence Desk, filling in as host today for Marsha Baker and Harley Slanger on a very historic occasion. 2 days from now, November 9th, marks the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. You've just heard an excerpt of Beethoven's Ode to Joy, or Schiller's Ode to Joy, set to music by Beethoven in his Ninth Symphony. That music filled Berlin on November 9th, 1989, 20 years ago. Also, November 10th marks the 250th birthday of Friedrich Schiller, the poet of freedom, whose significance was brought to the United States more than 30 years ago by Helga Zepp LaRouche, the founder of the Schiller Institute, and who is the subject today, along with Lyndon LaRouche, of our discussion. That discussion, Organizing for the Four Powers, Two Decades of Interventions by Lyndon LaRouche and Helga LaRouche, to bringing the United States into an alliance with China, Russia, and India for a true, just world economic order. My special guests today are Rachel Douglas, who handles the Russia desk for EIR, and LaRouche Youth Movement leader Ouyang Teng from the notorious and famous Basement Project of the LYM. Rachel has worked closely with Helga and Lyndon LaRouche in their trips to Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union for years. And today she works night and day to handle the massive amount of activity, especially on the internet website activity, surrounding the writings, webcasts, speeches, and articles of Lyndon and Helga LaRouche. Before we hear from Rachel, who I've asked to give us a bit of an introduction to the Four Powers idea and the organizing, let me say one brief thing. We have a crisis in the United States. We need a change. The Obama presidency is a disaster, and there is no recovery from this disaster without a Four Powers Agreement. Today, Lyndon LaRouche said we're in the middle of an unmediated breakdown of the world system. It's in process, and the worst case is in the United States. Barack Obama is going down. Who will go down with him? Who will he bring down? He's bringing down the whole world. Unemployment in the United States is 10.2%, which we know is an underestimation, but that's the official Bureau of Labor Statistics release this week. That's only people collecting unemployment and actively looking for jobs right now. As EIR has said, the true unemployment in the United States is between 20 and 30%. It varies week by week. It's a disaster. And the turning point that LaRouche forecast for mid-October has occurred, and what we saw on Tuesday of this week, Election Day, was a resounding rejection of the failure of Barack Obama. There is a mass strike movement out there, a mass strike movement that we saw in East Germany 20 years ago that brought down the Berlin Wall and one of the worst dictatorships standing on the planet at that time. And that's what we look forward to today. On July 25th, precisely 2007, Lyndon LaRouche warned that the world financial system was finished. And now he has put forward the LaRouche plan and the Four Powers Agreement that can provide a world solution. So with that, Rachel, I'd like to ask you to tell us about Mr. LaRouche's organizing and his approach to solving this existential crisis, and particularly Helga LaRouche's recent activities, including her October 29th webcast. So, hello, Rachel.
Hi, Michelle. Hi, Ouyang. Hi. I think the October 29th webcast will serve us very well as a point of departure and a guideline for reviewing the activity of Helga LaRouche as leader of the Schiller Institute and Lyndon LaRouche as leader of the LaRouche PAC movement in the United States and really the movement of his friends and supporters around the world, not just now, but over that entire historic 20 years since November 9th, 1989. She, in the webcast, reviewed many of the highlights of that organizing, and I think we can visit those during our conversation. I was thinking, Michelle, as you introduced the show with citing those dates, that today, the 7th of November, is also a historic anniversary. It used to be the national holiday in the Soviet Union. It was the anniversary of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, known as the October Revolution. They changed the calendar, so the October Revolution actually had taken place on what was November 7th under the modern calendar.
Oh, boy.
But that brings home, and that, of course, is not the national holiday anymore in Russia or the other post-Soviet states. But it brings home to us that the Berlin Wall coming down was not only the end of the 28 years that that wall stood there, dividing Germany and the city of Berlin, but it was the end of the way the entire world had been divided between East and West since the death of Franklin Roosevelt at the end of World War II, dashed the possibility of implementing Roosevelt's vision of a non-colonial, anti-imperial post-World War II order. Actually, it is the way the world had been divided since the disaster known as World War I, which was the outcome, which was orchestrated as the outcome of a desperate British imperial geopolitical project organized and pushed over a 40-year period since the defeat of British interests in the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, had opened the way, opened the potential for an alliance of sovereign nations, including the United States, Germany, Russia, Japan, China, to develop all of Eurasia and other parts of the world. And that, of course, would have meant the end of the British Empire already at the end of the 19th century. World War I was the outcome of British efforts to prevent that from, to destroy that potential. And, of course, the division of Europe, East and West, the formation of the Soviet Union, followed out of World War I. But especially if we think about the period since World War II, since the death of Roosevelt, the wall coming down 20 years ago was followed 2 years later by the Soviet Union itself breaking up. And in that time period, I remember very clearly, and I'm sure you do too, Michelle, how often Lyndon LaRouche said, and he was saying this from prison as a political prisoner of the Bush senior regime at the time, said that the collapse of the Soviet system is the first shoe dropping. Right. And the second shoe will drop. And what's the second shoe? The second shoe dropping would be, said LaRouche, the demise of that British system of monetarism, the system of renewed colonialism through financial looting. We call it globalization today. And LaRouche said at that time, and he said this to guests from Russia who began to come to visit him in prison, and I'll mention one of those in a moment, he said that the British system, the Anglo-American or City of London Wall Street, because it's not really American system, will crash just as certainly as the Soviet bloc had fallen apart, as he also correctly had forecast and warned Soviet leaders in the early 1980s. This, too, is part of the picture, part of the story, that it was the failure of Soviet leaders under Yuri Andropov and Mikhail Gorbachev to accept from President Reagan LaRouche's policy for cooperation on the Strategic Defense Initiative. on a crash program of military, scientific, but then with spin-offs for the civilian sector, development to change the doctrine, to end the tyranny, the reign of terror known as mutual assured destruction that had us all growing up with the threat of the bomb over our heads. And LaRouche's, what became the Strategic Defense Initiative, had been LaRouche's initiative, was offered to the Soviets by President Reagan, and they turned it down because of the nature of those particular Soviet leaders. And Lyndon warned his Soviet interlocutors at the time, because he was functioning in what's known as a back-channel diplomatic role, that if they attempted to outstrip the United States militarily, that they would strain their military economy, they would strain their whole economy to the breaking point, and that would be the end of their empire. And he said within 5 years, it happened within six. So because of that track record, that LaRouche was right, he enjoys an extraordinary authority in Russia to this day, among people who were around 20 years ago, and it's been passed on to subsequent generations in various channels which have to do with these trips and visits and organizing. But I just wanted to cite this long memory in a very interesting way that it came out just this month and at the end of October. As Michelle mentioned, I'm responsible for our Russian language website. And I can report that over the past 2 weeks, the most frequently visited page on our Russian website is an item which dates from 1993. And now we've posted a lot in the last 2 weeks. We're posting Mr. LaRouche's webcasts with Russian voiceover. We have just posted Helga LaRouche's new public appeal, which everybody should sign. You can find it on the Schiller Institute site and the LaRouche Tech site, appeal for the LaRouche plan to be put on the agenda. So we have plenty of current material. But the interview of Lyndon LaRouche done by Viktor Kuzin, a prominent Russian human rights activist already during the Soviet period, in 1993, as a matter of fact, exactly 16 years ago, on November 1st, 1993, that was our number one entrance point to the site and most visited page over the past 2 weeks. I think it had a couple of thousand people looking at and reading. Well, because on October 10th, Lyndon and Helga took part in the seventh annual forum called the World Public Forum Dialogue of Civilizations, which is held on the Greek island of Rhodes. And Mr. LaRouche's speech to that meeting was on the four powers, the need for an alliance and cooperation amongst Russia, the United States, China, and India to take the initiative to create a new world credit system. And as he put it there, he said, the task, as I defined it, is for Russia, the USA, and China and India to agree as a group of countries to initiate and force a reorganization of the world financial and credit system with long-term agreements of the same type that Franklin Roosevelt had uttered before his death. Again, that key reference point, 1944-45. The intention of Roosevelt all these years later could have been realized, and we could do that today. That's our chance. And he went on to spell out how this would be the end of globalization and the monetary system, which he stated is now a disease. Now, that speech, that forum, the Rhodes Forum, is actually co-initiated and co-sponsored by three individuals. One is Greek. The other two are from two of the four powers, Jagjit Kapoor of India and Vladimir Yakunin, who is the chief executive of Russian Railways, very large state-owned Russian infrastructure company. So there were many Russians in the audience at the Rhodes Forum. One of them was a well-known journalist, the deputy editor of a nationalist weekly newspaper called Zavtra, which means tomorrow. And Mr. Nagorny of Zavtra, on October 21st, less than 2 weeks after the Rhodes Forum, published a summary in Zavtra of his interview of Mr. LaRouche. This, the full transcript of which, by the way, is appearing in the current issue of EIR. So those of you who don't yet subscribe to EIR online can get a subscription and read Alexander Nagorny's conversation with Lyndon LaRouche. Viktor Kuzin, inspired by the interview publication in Zavtra, wrote an open letter to the president of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, and sent it to President Medvedev's blog. And that letter said many things, including the following. If we wish to restore a sovereign Russia, I believe that Mr. LaRouche's position on the current financial and economic crisis deserves special, very serious attention because it is not based on short-term considerations. It is competent. It is backed up by the experience of accuracy in forecasting over decades. It is globally responsible, and it indicates a real way out of a general catastrophe. And Mr. Kuzin included his name and ID and the fact that he had interviewed LaRouche in prison in 1993, and he gave the link to our site. So that's how we come to have thousands of people reading an interview from 16 years ago as highly relevant to the question of whether these four countries could and will take the initiative to bring the world out of the danger of an immediate dark age now. So I think we'll be reviewing how we got to the point where the four powers are so important today. That's what Helga addressed in her October 29th webcast.
Okay, I'm going to take us back, listeners, to the LaRouche Show. I'm going to take us all back 20 years through the voice of Helga Zepp LaRouche herself. This is very, very important, and we're going to get a lot of perspectives on this. After we hear Helga, I'm going to ask Ouyang, who's a young man in his 20s, to comment on, to comment on the significance of these events 20 years ago. Some young people who are in university right now weren't even born. Others were too young to remember. But this was a defining moment, a turning point in history. And we're going to hear a message that Helga sent to the American population in 1989 about this historic event. So, George, our producer, are we ready for that?
Dear Americans, I think you all have seen in recent days these extremely exciting moving pictures from Berlin. You know that the borders between East and West Germany have been opened. And the wall in Berlin, while it is still there, has practically come down. When this happened on the joyful 9th of November, in the first evening, 100,000 people immediately came over from East Berlin to West Berlin to taste what the new freedom would look like. On Sunday, 3 million people came, and the stream has not ended since. Well, so also into West Germany, people came, they embraced each other, and you know the people were so happy, and the West German people, they overcame all normal kind of behavior, they showed a tremendous hospitality, they opened champagne, they gave food, they invited people for dinner, people were climbing the wall from both sides. The Ode to Joy, the symbol of the fight for freedom, was sang on the most important street in Berlin, the Kudamm. And the Symphony of West Berlin played for free the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, and they perform two times the magic flute. Well, let me tell you, I think this is a genuine, real revolution. It's a revolution of agape, of love, of charity, not a revolution of rage. And as one woman from the DDR said correctly, Schiller, in this situation, proves to be the real revolutionary. And you remember the famous sentence in the Ode to Joy, all men become brethren. So if you think back, how quickly did this happen? Well, one cannot forget the man who predicted this on the 12th of October, namely Lyndon LaRouche. Lynn and I went to West Berlin more than a year ago, and he made his very famous Berlin speech at that time, which simply said that the Soviet Union, within a very short period of time, would face a tremendous food shortage and a collapse of their physical economy. That the West, as a war avoidance policy, should offer a crash program for Poland to take that burden off their shoulders and prove with Western technologies and methods how an economy can be built, you know, in a very short period of time. This should be offered to the Soviet Union in return for the demand for free elections in East Germany and Poland, and with the prospect of having a German reunification soon. Well, being there with Lynn, I can tell you nobody at that time believed that this was a realistic political proposal. Shortly afterwards, the later part of October, Lynn called for a worldwide anti-Bolshevik resistance movement. And again, I can tell you, people said this may be a noble cause, but it is not very realistic in our time. You all know that 2 days later, after Lynn made this call for an international anti-Bolshevist resistance movement, Lynn was indicted, railroaded, and then put in jail. But the year of 89, where he is sitting innocently in jail, proved that he was absolutely on the mark concerning the collapse of the Soviet Union. The convulsions started already in the beginning of the year, and then in the month of May, in Peking on Tiananmen Square, the students demonstrated for freedom, and they used the Statue of Liberty as a symbol, and they used the Ode to Joy as their melody. So, you know, the massacre could not stop their fight for freedom. In June, still, the Gorby mania was at a high point when Gorbachev came to Bonn, West Germany. But, you know, we predicted, and Lynn in particular said immediately after the Tiananmen Square massacre happened on the 4th of June, that this would mean the end of the condominium between the superpowers. And he has proven, again, to be extremely correct. Already in the month of August, in the DDR, the resistance took some concrete form. In the beginning, it started with a mass in Leipzig, which became bigger and bigger. The attendance became larger and larger. Then people added candlelight demonstrations every Monday to demonstrate for the cause of freedom and, you know, that they did not like this dictatorship anymore. In the months of September and October, these candlelight demonstrations doubled every Monday. On the 10th of October, you still had the 40th anniversary of socialism in the DDR, which was not a celebration, it was more like a funeral. Honecker was still there, but everybody knew this was, you know, socialism as an ideology is coming to an end. And only 4 weeks later, on the 9th of November, the borders to the DDR, to West Germany were opened. Well, we have indications that, you know, the fact that there were demonstrations of 1 million people in East Berlin, and people were shouting, "We are the people, we are the people," and the fact that there was a general strike practically about to erupt the moment when they opened the border, where the SED leadership knew they could not hold out any longer. Especially because since the beginning of the year, 200,000 people of a people of 16 million had left, many qualified workers and engineers and so forth. So they feel really that their system collapses if they don't go for reforms. So what will happen now? The SED will have a special party day by mid of December. They will have to allow other parties and organizations, and there is no way how this will not lead to free election. And I'm totally convinced German reunification will happen. So it is very important that Germany in this situation develops an identity to be a force for good in the world. And therefore, I'm working together with all my colleagues and associates that Germany is not just happy to be now this country where unity is hopefully possible in the very near future, but that we pick up Lynn's proposal to help Poland, because people in Poland are starving and they will face an extremely hard winter. So Germany must help Poland in its economic reconstruction, because Poland is really culturally part of the West. It's part of Europe. And therefore, because they have the same culture, it has a very strong affinity to absorb technological progress and the way of technological development through West and East Germany into Poland is the most natural one. We are also trying to get France totally involved in this question of German reunification as an anchor and security that this reunification takes place with a total orientation of being part of the West. So we will offer the Soviet Union help, but in return for the unification, in return for free elections, not only in the DDR in Poland, but eventually everywhere, we have to create a new alliance between Paris, Bonn, Berlin and Warsaw. And this is also the way where the railroad system has to be enlarged, because the biggest problem of the Polish economy right now, or one of the biggest problems, is that they have no transport and they need a totally new railway system. So the key will be to link the rail system going from Paris to Bonn to Berlin into the Polish economy and build new rails in Poland. So that means, basically, if we do this, I think Poland can be saved. This is, right now, the thinking in West Germany, I think people have a tremendous cultural optimism. And I think what we have seen in East Germany and what we are seeing, really coming like a wave of similar reactions into West Germany is really a revolution of agape, of love. And I think, there are very rare moments in history where people can intervene and turn the situation for the better. I think we are facing right now such a moment. And I want to say this, that Lynn, who anticipated this in a nearly prophetic way, I think you should really think about it in this way. If the walls in Berlin can come down, the walls of injustice will come down soon in the United States. Thank you.
You listen to the voice of Helga Zeplerush, founder of the Schiller Institute, speaking to Americans in 1989, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Helga Zeplerush, the head of the Buso political party in Germany, wife of American economist and statesman Lyndon LaRouche, is now at the forefront of organizing with her husband the Four Powers Agreement. Now, let me be clear, listeners, what we're talking about. There is no way out of the American political and financial crisis without allying with Russia, China, and India. That's what LaRouche's Four Powers Agreement is about. And you can send your questions into this radio show at radio@larouchepub.com. And now I'm going to turn the discussion over to back to Rachel Douglas and first Ouyang Teng, who has probably some insights and questions about this.
Yeah, it's true what you said about, I think that there is something important for people, you know, my age or roughly my age, who were children when this was happening. I actually was in Germany in August of 89 on a family trip. I can say that when I was 6 years old,
wow,
the geopolitics of Soviet-American relations and things like that weren't my first priority. But what's become clear in the last few years, I mean, particularly organizing in this movement, is sort of a shocking realization that, you know, I lived and my generation lived through a revolutionary moment, a moment when an entire system collapsed. Now, as, you know, as something that's an internal experience, I think that's maybe much more sharply felt by people who were there, by older generations, but nonetheless, it's part of our experience. And it becomes more and more clear when you think about the aftermath, the 90s, you know, the craziness around the dot-com bubble, which is much, much closer to my own, you know, experience in the Bay Area at that time. But then reflecting back on, you know, what Lynn and Helga and others have brought to light about the missed opportunity. And I think I watched Natalia Vitrenko's speech or her presentation, which is on our website, just yesterday, and I think it brought it home there too, where you see there was a real utter collapse, physical economic collapse in the Soviet and East Bloc countries, which to my mind really underscores what Lynn is saying now about the potential relative population density of the planet having dropped to the level of about 2 billion people. In other words, that we can only support about 2 billion people at current under current policies. And, you know, what she was discussing in terms of the depopulation in Ukraine, the complete deindustrialization there, what's been discussed in the case of Russia, the near collapse of the space program, collapse of industrial production, the collapse of the population, the life expectancies. I was wondering, I mean, just having run through this in my mind, if maybe Rachel could say something about that in terms of,
yes,
really getting a visceral sense of what it means, not as a number out of the air, but really what it means to say that we can only support, you know, a few billion people now, that is what's facing us as far as a rapid collapse of population, that it's actually happened. The process has already been set in motion.
You know, Oh Young, I remember this idea, this truth that you just referred to, striking me very hard in 1994 at our first international conference held in the United States with Lyndon after he came out of being a political prisoner. And we gave with some of our Eastern European guests, already then, just 5 years after the wall had come down, 3 years after the Soviet Union broke up, a seminar in Washington, D.C., at which a young Ukrainian political figure named Taras Chornovil, who had taken it upon himself to translate LaRouche's book, So You Wish to Learn All About Economics, into Ukrainian. We have put it out in Russian. He from there translated it into Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. Just said very matter-of-factly in his presentation about the precipitous collapse of the living standard, industry, transport, employment, healthcare in Ukraine. He said, well, what we have in Ukraine is that the potential relative population density has dropped below the level of the population. Hmm. Now, this was not an unfamiliar term to me. In fact, I have ground into my head the Russian initials for potential relative population density, which are popen, because I worked intensely on helping translate the book into Russian. And I said, oh, you know, this idea suddenly came alive to me very personally, you know, because it was personal for him and concretely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, the potential relative population density of Ukraine has fallen below the level of the population. And what Natalia Vitrenko, the Ukrainian economist and other political figure, spelled out in a presentation from a couple of weeks ago, which Oyong mentioned, is indeed that the absolute population of Ukraine today at 46 million is 7 million less than what it was at the time that the Soviet Union broke up. And it's 13 million less than what it would have been had there simply been a linear extrapolation of the previous rates of expansion of population. So people have died in large numbers in this part of the world as kind of a pre-taste of what the entire planet is destined to. Mm-hmm. Some places have gotten there earlier, like countries in Africa, because of the hideous looting of their populations by London-centered finance.
Yeah. The thing
is that it was deliberate.
Right.
That it was deliberate. And, you know, this, the parties involved and were Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Britain, François Mitterrand, and George Bush Sr. We said this throughout the period, that unless you moved immediately to implement, as Helga said in that clip, railroad construction, investment that would be mutually beneficial, building up industry, resuscitating infrastructure, unless you did that, that these areas would be turned very, very quickly into the new sources of loot to try to prop up the financial bubble. And that's what happened. That's what, when we say the lost opportunity, it's not that people just sat around and did nothing and things didn't go so well. It's that there was a conscious looting and stealing policy which killed huge numbers of people as it killed the economies in these parts of the world. That took place in Russia throughout the 90s, as LaRouche had warned them under President Yeltsin, and they're still living with consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And just this year, just this spring, documents, as people may have heard, were released in which Margaret Thatcher was confirmed to be saying to Gorbachev, to be expressing her and Britain's utter opposition to the reunification of Germany. They wanted to keep the division of Europe that could be and of the world, to manipulate the East-West conflict, and they wanted to prevent Germany becoming an industrial powerhouse, which would undercut British interests on the continent of Europe and Eurasia. It sounds like 100 years earlier.
I think one of the things we have to grapple as organizers is perhaps denial. People think it can't happen or it can't happen here. And there are signs that it is happening here. I mentioned, of course, briefly 10.2% unemployment clocked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics last month. But we also have really criminal negligence, if not criminal intent in refusing to deal with sanitation, with the spread of the H1N1 flu, lack of vaccines, lack of delivery, and the shutdown of the public health system. And this is going on globally. I'd like to talk a little bit about the solutions and what we have accomplished just in this very, very brief period since October 10th, the Rhodes Conference. Rachel, I'd like to ask you to speak a little bit more about the Zavtra, the tomorrow interview. And there's also, I understand, some pretty exciting developments with a Chinese website.
Yes, there are people volunteering to translate LaRouche's writings into the languages spoken in the four powers, because in each of those countries there's an important layer of people who, either because they just got the idea now, but really more because they have been at some level in a discussion or dialogue process with Lyndon LaRouche going back 20 and 30 years, have grasped that he's right and that you must have this cooperation. The co-organizer of the Rhodes Conference, Mr. Yakunin, was 2 days later part of the delegation of Russian Prime Minister Putin in Beijing. This is the annual government-to-government heads of government meeting, but it was by no means routine. And the nature of the bilateral agreements signed between Russia and China, including not only sale of Russian natural gas for Chinese industry or oil types of things, which has been on the agenda before and are still on the agenda, but it included a whole new dimension of Chinese investment in building Russian infrastructure in the Russian Far East, including some projects of Russian railways, which are very optimistic ones and are very important for the potential development of all Eurasia and a relationship with the Western Hemisphere, including even the link over the Bering Strait, which is part of Russian railways plans up to the year 2030. Those have all been in jeopardy of not getting built because of the crisis and the Russian budget shortages of funds. And so, for starters, China will be investing in helping to complete and accomplish the high-speed rail component of Russia's plans for their rail upgrading. There are whole port complexes, as at Vladivostok, being built. There are things related to raw materials, such that LaRouche said, we can see these agreements as a stepping stone to a four-power initiative. He said, it's not all the way, because you know what's going on in the United States. The United States is not yet in the picture in the way that it must be. But implicitly, said LaRouche, if China, as the world's biggest holder of dollar debt, that is U.S. Treasuries, instead of just having that money in their reserves and as something that they might lose at any given moment as the dollar system pyramid of debt collapses, if they turn and invest Chinese resources in real infrastructure and industry development in Russia on a cooperative basis with Russia, then you've changed the rules of the game. And this is not just one more deal. This implicitly turns those dollar holdings of China into something that they were not before. And LaRouche underscored that the Chinese-Russian agreements mean that China's U.S. dollar reserves are now worth something real if they're being invested in infrastructure and physical production. So it's the right direction. Now, you can tell that it's the right direction by how furiously this idea is being attacked. And I've actually just been mapping this out the last few days, that there are very blatant attempts to organize a backlash in Russia against these arrangements with China on the grounds that this will be just one more country looting Russian raw materials just the way Britain or the United States has wanted to loot raw materials. There's some more sophisticated arguments saying, okay, well, Russia, China, that's all very well for cooperation, and maybe we can set some things up with the European Union, but keep the United States out. This line is especially being promoted in certain European circles that are under the influence of, shall we say, Tony Blair's conception of the European Union as a new imperial entity. I was informed by Mrs. LaRouche this week about publication in a German newspaper, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, where a commentator wrote a major, major article saying that Europe should turn away from the United States and towards Asia and should have a new Monroe Doctrine to keep the United States out of the Eastern Hemisphere, out of Eurasia, and cited 1823, the Monroe Doctrine of the United States of keeping Britain out of the Western Hemisphere as a precedent. Now, I must say this is a completely fraudulent argument, and we'll say so, because the Monroe Doctrine was not a geopolitical carve the world into the two hemispheres doctrine. It was an anti-imperial policy authored by our great president, John Quincy Adams. And Adams also is the author of the concept of a community of principles, that the best foreign policy for your nation, that the policy that's really in your national interest, is the one that is consonant with the common tasks of mankind, what we also call the Westphalian principle, after the Treaties of Westphalia, which ended the slaughter of the so-called 30 Years' War in Europe in 1648. But there's the principle of the Monroe Doctrine, community of principle, came from John Quincy Adams, who, by the way, was a great advocate of a Russian-American alliance against British imperial interests. And I know we don't have time to go into this in detail, but I just want to say that within the debate in Russia today, partly, I think, in an important way, because of the extent to which LaRouche has insisted on reviving this concept of the Russian-American alliance against the British Empire, there's a whole layer of people, especially from the foreign policy and intelligence community, who know that that principle is efficient in history. We had a curious example of that this week, or to some people maybe it appeared curious, when there was a tour of the United States by a Russian professor named Igor Panarin, A-N-A-R-I-N. He's a dean at the Diplomatic Academy of the Russian Foreign Ministry. And he's infamous for having various scenarios of the United States breaking into six ethnic units. Those can be put on a shelf somewhere to gather dust. But what was striking is that at two speeches, one in Washington, D.C., and one in Houston, Texas, where members of the LaRouche Youth Movement were present, Mr. Panarin said, the threat to the United States comes from London-centered financial interests. And in his presentation, he went through extensive references to the alliance between Catherine the Great and the American revolutionaries with the League of Armed Neutrality against the British during our War of Independence, and especially he referred to the Tsar Alexander II and Abraham Lincoln alliance in the U.S. Civil War. Anti-British alliances. So this notion of bringing back the vision of FDR, which was cooperation of the Soviet Union, the United States, and China for a post-colonial world. India at that point was only just getting its independence from the British Empire, but really it was the germ of the Four Powers Agreement. That idea is so much alive and so realistic. Some people in Russia, some people in the United States, as you said, Michelle said, think that it's pie in the sky. You know, why should an alliance with Russia, China, and India solve our problems? So on the Russian side, what do we need these blast Americans in Eurasia for? Don't they just cause trouble? That suicidal and shallow and manipulated thinking can be overcome with the revival of these powerful historical ideas of the common interest with the four powers. And, you know, Lyndon always says that the importance of the four powers is not only that Russia and the United States are two nuclear powers and China and India have the largest population in the world. It's that these countries are different. They represent different cultural traditions, informed by those traditions, looking to the best in each other's traditions, their combined force great enough to defeat the enemies of all mankind.
Ouyang, I'm going to turn to you because apropos of what Rachel just said about people not seeing the power of the four powers, we just got a question in from Chesapeake, Virginia, from a listener who obviously supports the four powers goal, but says, monkey wrench in the four powers goal. Good conversation, but my mind is focused on the attempts here in the USA to foil LaRouche's plan. Particularly, I am thinking about the House vote this evening, by which I believe he's referring to the Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama attempt at dictatorship to force the vote on the Nazi health care plan. What do you say about that? Ouyang, I'm going to let you take a crack at this.
Well, I guess I can paraphrase LaRouche on that. His comment today was, we don't know what's going to happen. We know what we can know is what we've set in motion. What we should, you know, concentrate on, I think, is what are those sort of those lines of development that Rachel was going through as far as the four powers. And frankly, you're not going to get anything out of the Congress. It's probably a waste of a lot of emotional energy to worry too much about the Congress per se, since we know exactly what we're dealing with there under Pelosi and the rest of them. It seems like the organizing perspective, I think one feature of the four powers now, which is, I think more has come more to the surface than even in 89, 90, 91, is this element of the Moon Mars project, because it seems to me that there you have to read these historical moments for what they are, and the kind of impetus that you need to provide now in terms of a conception of what people's common interest are, you know, what are the things that are worth fighting for, I think it's encapsulated in the conception of cooperation on 50-year perspective. And a 50-year perspective, one, is obviously going to be centered on Eurasia. It's going to be centered on these four powers, just as a sort of an objective fact. But then a 50-year perspective from the standpoint of wanting to get to the point, as Lynn has laid out, of, say, the capability to carry out an accelerated trip to Mars, that use that as to sort of pull people forward from the future. And it's not an impossible task, especially given the fact that China, Russia, and India seem to be the most enthusiastic and the most ambitious countries as far as their space programs relative to what they have right now. I mean, there's a lot of planning and a fair amount of cooperation and much more that's possible around that. And it seems from that perspective, then you actually have a conceptual and a sort of an emotional foothold then to deal with the more practical elements of cooperation on the ground. You know, the rail, power, water management, and those kinds of things. But to the extent that you get stuck in trying to read the court politics of any of these countries, it's just going to be demoralizing, and you're not going to be able to do much.
Now, staying on that Moon Mars mission, that's a key part of the LaRouche plan. One of the main things that you mentioned, accelerated propulsion, doesn't that beg the question of fusion power, which is something our organization was founded on?
Yeah. The thing about the thing that to me is so exciting about this, the project as Lynn has defined it, is that here you would be forcing a shift into a nuclear-based economy, a shift into a fusion-based economy. And it's a shift which is not just a linear kind of change. You're not just upgrading a technology, say, quantitatively, but really qualitatively in terms of the actual ability to... It actually changes the self-conception of the population if you're mastering processes which have implications for interstellar flight, which have implications for materials processing on the Earth, for taking test cases like this region of Siberia, which LaRouche said again today really is in the mutual interest of China and Russia. You have this massive unpopulated or underpopulated, underdeveloped region in Siberia, which is heavy with mineral resources, that the only way you're going to be able to develop those is not by extraction per se, but by increasing the mode by intensifying the mode of operation. And the only way to get to, you know, to chart that pathway in a way that's feasible is through fission and fusion. And you begin to get into that domain of operation, then you've sort of taken down all of these external barriers that people point to and say, you know, these things, the lack of energy, et cetera, these are the things that prevent cooperation. Now you're really in a domain where you've defined the common interests of mankind, you're acting on them, and you realize that that's the only way, that's the only policy that any individual country can act on. So I think an aggressive push on that front sort of breaks some of the ingrained axioms about how you're supposed to discuss international relations.
I'm really glad you said what you said, quoting Lynn about the Congress. And I would add to our listener from Chesapeake, Virginia, Linda LaRouche often points to Percy Bysshe Shelley's In Defense of Poetry, especially the final paragraph, which says near the end or at the end, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. It's mm-hmm. ideas that change history, and the idea that we are the people changed history in East Germany 20 years ago, and the mass strike here in the United States, we are the people, can change it in the direction that Ouyang just was talking about today. Rachel, I thought we were going to be able to go through in detail the various wonderful interventions that you participated in. Linda LaRouche's, I think it was 1995, first economic presentation in Moscow.
94.
94, okay. Wow, the very same year that he was released from prison, and the 2001 Duma presentation. So we have 1 minute where you can do that.
We can do those on another occasion because, look, those were the venues, whether it was testimony in the Economics Committee of the Duma or a seminar with leaders of the Academy of Sciences or a dozen other things. But the real intervention was what Ouyang just said. The real intervention is LaRouche's conception of what makes a human being and therefore what makes a patriot working with patriots of other nations. And I'll end with a couple of sentences from that 1993 interview where LaRouche was sitting in prison, interviewed by Mr. Cousin, whose country was under the thumb of the banker's dictatorship from international finance. And here's what LaRouche said to him. He said, the real intelligentsia, that is the educated patriot, deals with ideas in the following way, in the fashion of a scientist and a discoverer. What does he do? Like Mendeleev, the Russian chemist, Vernadsky, the biogeochemist. Such a person works someplace, he teaches, he walks in the street, and he sees the Russian people. And he asks himself, who am I in relation to these people? Then one day he looks in the mirror in his mind, and he sees something in himself which reminds him of Mendeleev. And he says, well, I'm one of these people too, but I've developed something in myself. My job is to develop it in other people. What Russian can want to go into the street and see his cousin drunk in the gutter? He says, what is this? Is this an animal or what is it? Or does he say, this person also has in him this quality which I call the living image of God, and it's demonstrated by the creative principle. And he says, I do not wish to see my cousins as beasts anymore. Yes, we have to work. We must have agriculture. We must have industry. It must be done as human beings, not as beasts. And the answer comes, can we do it tomorrow? No. They'll continue to suffer in drudgery, but their grandchildren shall not. And that is true patriotism. That is the function of the intelligentsia and of leadership, whether in Russia or Ukraine, said LaRouche. And it's true here, too.
That was a quote from Lyndon LaRouche sitting in prison in 1993. Nothing can imprison the spirit of that man. And we're out of time. Thank you for listening. Join our fight for the LaRouche Plan. Call 1-800-929-7566. Call for more literature. Call to join in the fight. It's your way to say thank you to Ouyang Teng and Rachel Douglas. And now we're going to turn to Friedrich Schiller, Ludwig von Beethoven, for our closing today, the Ode to Joy. Thank you for joining us.